Broadcasting from the beautiful Tenderloin in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. So anyway, it's great to be back with show number four. I'm getting more and more relaxed with each show, and I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I guess the programming will get more and more foolish, perhaps, as we go along. But I did want to raise something that really bothered me this week, or last week, I guess we could say. One day last week, I turned on the TV, you know, just to maybe get some news from one of the cable channels. Yeah, that's a joke. Or, you know, I was at least hoping to be entertained that somebody like Joe Scarborough would be screaming about some radical left-wing college professor that nobody would have heard of if Joe Scarborough hadn't started screaming about him. And, you know, those guys are, I find, the right-wing maniacs on TV talk pretty amusing. But on all five cable news channels, even on CNN, there was nothing, not one thing, on any channel but reports about this missing white chick in Aruba. And, of course, it's a tragedy. It's a terrible tragedy for anybody who's been killed or abused or kidnapped at any time. But at any given time, there are, like, hundreds of thousands of missing people in America alone. And no doubt they come from a wide assortment of races and genders. But the TV cable news channels always, constantly, except when they have a rich black man on trial, they always have one dead or missing white chick that they spend hours of every day talking about. And in fact, actually, just last week, they found a 9-year-old Cub Scout who had been missing for 4 days that week. But nobody knew he was missing because he's, you know, little dude. And they just assumed he was at Neverland. But anyway, seriously, what is this thing with dead or missing white chicks? Is there like a universal need for a damsel in distress bedtime story? And does the damsel in distress have to be white? Anybody have any thoughts or opinions about this?
Well, I heard a call-in guy say, I think it was a black guy on a radio show, said, they aren't just white, they're petite, they're usually blonde, they're not older than 25, and they're from upper middle class families.
Yeah, that's not always the case. There was the runaway bride was a little older, and of course Terry Schiavo was not, maybe she had been originally petite, but she was,
well, yeah,
Schrodinger's missing white chick in this case. Was she dead or was she alive? In which case the whole Congress had to be called in. But there are always these dramas, and they do tend to be petite, and they're always white. This is, you know, possibly the greatest expression of racism in America at this point. I mean, because it comes so clearly from the subconscious. It's not like cops running around beating up people.
But we still have all those.
What story evokes concern in people?
But it's those kind of middle-aged white men. Tom, what's his name? Tom, the newscasters.
Tom Brokaw.
But yeah, all those guys. They all look the same too, and they're talking about the same.
Yeah, well,
type.
They're not actually doing that. It's
well,
the
they're
cable
not doing
news,
it right
the cable
now.
News
but even
shows
so,
that are doing it. And one thing I noticed is that there's nothing about it in the newspaper. Which makes me respect the newspaper.
Ratings,
I mean, or there's very little.
Don't forget about ratings. I mean, a lot of this is fabricated by the media, you know, based on what they think is going to generate ratings. Or, you know, and one network sees a story on another network and says, "Oh, look at their numbers. We've got to follow that. We have to compete."
And they just stay with the story and
tell
it up.
Because they don't want to lose out.
There's a never-ending, line of dead or missing.
Is it cheap? Maybe it's cheap. Once they go to the location and then keep it up.
One of the things that bothers me is, like, you know, I'm not a fan of, like, Joe Scarborough or Sean Hannity or any of these, you know, right-wing screamers. But I do enjoy them talking about politics. And they even have these guys, instead of doing their usual show about some political issue, they have them talking about, you know, and you can see they're in pain.
Didn't this start with those girls in Yosemite?
No.
About 3 years ago? Remember those that got murdered?
Where did it start? No, it was started before that. I can't remember exactly where it started. Anyway, I mean, you know, obviously.
But they once had that little Puerto Rican or Latino girl from Vallejo.
Yeah.
She was like 8 years
old.
Yeah. Remember her?
Yeah,
I was surprised that she got so much press.
Yeah, but they didn't have like the constant cable drumbeat at that point, or did they?
They had a lot because it took
constant.
A while to find out what happened to her.
Yeah,
but nothing like Lacey Peterson.
Well, in any case, of course, we all do hope that they find this woman in Aruba and maybe our upcoming guest, Jack Sarfati, who knows how to time travel, can help us find her.
Do you think he should go forward or backward?
You can't go forward, right?
He should go sideways.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
All right, we're here with Jack Sarfati, and Jack has been a legend in the strange world of quantum physics since the 1970s. He was the director of the Physics Consciousness Research Group, a great group in Berkeley, California. A lot of people came out of that. And he was co-author of the popular 1970s book about quantum physics, Space, Time, and Beyond, that some of you may have in your libraries. More recent books include Destiny Matrix and Super Cosmos. Those are two books. Not one. And quoting directly from the bio from the publishers of Supercosmos, Jack has been working on the post-quantum physics of consciousness and the paranormal since he directed the famous Esalen seminars in 1976, described by Gary Zukav in The Dancing Wu Li Masters. And it also says, he is also working on the connection of the warp drive physics of flying saucers to the new cosmology observations of anti-gravity dark energy. Jack lectures on that topic, time travel, the art of the possible, in the Star Trek IV DVD Special Collector's Edition. So go out of your way to find that. And Sarfati is also rumored to have been the inspiration for the time-traveling character Dr. Emmett Brown in the Back to the Future trilogy. And Jack, did you drive over here in a DeLorean?
No, but I kept my Jaguar in my girlfriend's garage, and I came down the SUV. Glad I did.
The last time I interviewed you actually was for Mondo 2000 in 1991,
right.
It was along with Nick Herbert.
I didn't need Viagra then.
No, that's true. None of us did.
New
and none of us had an option either.
BV, right? Before Viagra and AV.
Little Terrence McKenna's Little Purple Men.
Just prone out of luck. And back then you were really obsessed with conducting experiments to show backwards in time effects.
Right.
Is that still an effect?
Yes, right. Well, I don't actually do experiments, of course. I'm just like an armchair theorist. But there have been several experiments being done. You know, Dean Radin first did quite a few experiments when he was being paid by Robert Bigelow at the University of Las Vegas. You know, Bigelow being the sort of the new Howard Hughes of Las Vegas, owns like 80,000 hotel rooms and funds all this weird paranormal flying saucer stuff. Employs a lot of ex-CIA, FBI, you know, police, army, intelligence people to go investigate.
Where can we hear more about him?
He now runs Bigelow Aerospace, which is a big, they want to put hotels out in space. But he's a very interesting character, definitely like the second Howard Hughes. In any case, he gave about 20 years ago, I guess it was. I'm not sure exactly when, but around that time, maybe 15 years ago, he gave $3 million to University of Las Vegas for Dean Radin to do these backwards in time kind of pre-sponse, what I call pre-sponse experiments. And Radin reported, you know, positive results. And then there was a guy named Dick Bierman, who's a very kind of, you know, mainstream professor of experimental psychology at some university in near Amsterdam, you know, in the Netherlands. Right. And he, Dick was a real skeptic, you know, and thought, oh, he disproved this nonsense.
Right.
But he's an honest scientist. And sort of like John Clauser, when John Clauser tried to disprove the Bell's inequality and sort of got the answer he didn't expect. Well, in any case, Dick Bierman got replicated the results, basically.
And have these results been published?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So if you just go on the web, do a Google Dick Bierman, B-I-E-R-M-A-N, and also do Dean Radin.
And maybe just for novices, can you give a quick description of what this is? How are they showing backwards in time?
Okay, what they're showing, it's a backwards in time effect on a very short time scale, like you know, a second and a half, but with the modern equipment, you can detect it. And what they do, they give emotionally strong stimuli to the subject, like some, there might be very violent images or very sexually erotic images, and it's all being done at random, and they're like or they may be neutral images, you know, that don't, you know, emotionally neutral images. And what happens is that the brain, the EEG that they're recording in the brain patterns show a characteristic anticipatory response, which is very different if it's going to be an emotionally charged image versus an emotionally neutral image. And what's happening, what they're seeing, is that the neural flashes, the objective electrical patterns recorded in the EEG anticipate the kind of image that's going to be seen about a second in the future.
Oh, yeah, okay, I've read about this. This is a little different from the stuff that you were talking about in the early 90s, which was about moving psions, I think, backwards in time?
No, that's sort of Hal Puthoff, I think. Hal Puthoff, tachyons, you mean?
Tachyons.
Yeah, that's Hal Puthoff was into that. I was sort of vaguely into that, maybe Nick Herbert's a little bit into that. But this is very different. And it would be, you know, today in quantum theory, there's a whole new thing called quantum computers, quantum information theory, and quantum teleportation, in which basically what you have, the universe is naturally split into what Henry Stapp calls a thought-like aspect and then a rock-like or material aspect. Mm-hmm. And the quantum mechanical waves are really kind of mental thought waves, in essence. You can read more about this in Henry Stapp's, go to Henry Stapp's website. He is a professor at Berkeley, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. He's probably retired now, but he has a website. And also, if you go to the Stuart Hameroff site and look at the books by Roger Penrose, like The Emperor's New Mind, Shadows of the Mind, and, of course, the new book, which is kind of mathematical, called The Road to Reality. It's all in there. So, you know.
So is this sort of a physics of consciousness as opposed to physics and consciousness?
No, it's a physics. The problem is it's a physics of consciousness. The issue is, what is there in the physical universe, in terms of known physics, that can explain why there should be such a thing as consciousness? And, you know, I have a particular set of ideas about how it works. Roger Penrose is one of the world's greatest mathematicians. He's a full professor at Oxford and fellow of the Royal Society, you know, very, very established. And he has slightly different ideas from my ideas, but, you know, he has ideas of how consciousness arises or emerges from a well-known physical and biological phenomena. So that's what the problem is.
And that's the subject of your Destiny Matrix.
Well, my book Destiny Matrix. Well, my book Destiny Matrix is a hodgepodge, because what it really is a kind of autobiography. It's really kind of rough notes toward a later book. So it's on many different levels. It has a lot of my true life adventures, which were rather unusual, to say the least. And plus, it's an intellectual autobiography of the evolution of some of my ideas. Some of them were crazy at the beginning, and now, as I get older,
they get crazy.
They get crazier, or maybe better. I don't know. It's like that's for the reader to judge.
Actually, your publisher wrote about Destiny Matrix that it discusses historical facts about the New Age occult and the rise of fascism and Nazism, of Cold War Soviet espionage in America using psychic warfare and the origins of Reagan's Star Wars.
Yes, it has all those pretty, plus other things. Yeah.
So you got some dynamic stuff going on there in terms of politics.
Like, it's kind of like the sequel to the book Morning of the Magicians by Pauls and Bergier.
Fascinating book.
You remember that book, yeah.
Sure.
And it's like a continuation of that, because also when Fred Allen Wolf and I were in Paris, like, when was that, 1973, 74, we met some of those people.
Right.
You know, that I talked about, Morning of the Magicians. Also, it ties in with the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
You know, we met, you know, although the Priory of Zion, that's part of the Da Vinci Code fiction,
right,
is itself largely a fiction, there are aspects about it that are actually true, although it's not the way it's told by Dan Brown. And it's but there, if you look at the book by Holy Blood, Holy Grail, in which Dan Brown got a lot of his information, there's stuff there that correlates with real things, although that guy, whatever his name was, I forget what his name, Plantard. I mean, he's
Plantard.
Yeah, Plantard.
He's
a phony.
Alleged to have started.
He's a neo-Nazi phony. But yeah, there is there are very deep connections.
So, I mean, have you run into something that you can definitively say that this is a secret society?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Can you describe something that?
If you look at the book Space Time Beyond, you'll see the book is dedicated to Carlos Suarez, who was a Kabbalist at the time Fred Allen Wolf, Bob Tobin, and I met him in 73. He was an 84-year-old man. He was he was the inspiration for the character Balthazar in Lawrence Durrell's The Alexandria Quartet. He's a close friend of Krishnamurti. He knew David Bohm. You know, he was part of that whole movement with Anis Nin and Jean-Paul Sartre. And he was a Sephardic Jew, like my father's side, born in Alexandria, Egypt. He was heavily involved in covert intelligence operations in World War II, which is why he was allowed. I mean, he had a strange relationship with the Nazi occupation in Paris at the time, because he had this beautiful penthouse right at the edge of the Champ de Mars, and he was allowed to keep it throughout the entire Nazi occupation, even though he was known to be a Jew. See, but he was also had connections.
Now you have some Mussolini blood, don't you? Also,
well, I don't have Mussolini blood, but there are weird. Yeah, there are connections. Cousins of mine who I never knew personally. Although my father's aunt, Victoria Sarfati, I think did know Margherita Sarfati, and Margherita Sarfati actually created Benito Mussolini. She was in her early 20s. This is like the turn of the century.
She launched his career. Wasn't he an anarchist?
She launched his career.
He was an anarchist originally.
They were socialists. They were socialists together. Mm-hmm. But what he was, Margherita met him when he was like an 18-year-old street hoodlum.
Right.
And she was from a very wealthy Jewish family. In fact, her father ran the Vatican Treasury for Pope Pius X. You know, she went out. She knew Einstein. She knew Marconi was a friend of hers till the end. She was a brilliant feminist, actually, and was involved in the women's movement. She helped create the women's movement, at least in Italy, back at the turn of the century, the early 20th century. And she was part of the futurist movement, Marionetti. In fact, I just got back from New York City, and at the Jewish Museum right now in New York City on East 92nd Street and Fifth Avenue, there's a big exhibit of Jewish intellectual women of the 20th century and how their salons influenced history.
That,
yes,
actually.
And there's a whole wall about Margherita Sarfati, a connection with Pablo Picasso. I mean, she was really connected to the art world. A brilliant, brilliant woman, and she created Romanita, you know, Mare Nostrum. She was very. I mean, she sort of shaped fascist policy. But you remember Mussolini was popularly elected. You know, this is way before Hitler. They were in power way before. There was no Hitler at that. I mean, there was no Nazism. This was way before 1933 when all this was happening. And so she. I mean, and it's there's a book called Il Duce's Other Woman by Philip Canestraro and Brian Sullivan, which give all the details, like a 1,000-page book. And there's no question there would not have been Mussolini without Margherita Sarfatti, sort of, you know, as the woman behind the throne, so to speak.
Well, speaking of Jack Sarfatti's past, we have a surprise. We're going to play a little clip of music from an opera that Jack Sarfatti was part of 40 years ago, and then we'll be back talking to Jack. You've been talking about post-quantum physics, and your latest project is called Making Star Trek Real, Making Star Trek Real, sure, with metric engineering the fabric of space-time.
Right.
Now, can you give us a layman's description of what you're up to there?
Yeah, I should first give a little credit to Harold Puthoff, who coined the term metric engineering. And metric engineering is the use of, ideally, relatively small amounts of energy in order to warp the shape of space-time for flight purposes and also for like Stargate wormholes, like on, exactly like on SG-1, actually, so that we can travel to distant parts of our universe in a very short time, effectively faster than light, and also even time travel backwards in time under certain conditions. Even though Stephen Hawking seems to think it's not possible, I think he's probably wrong.
What
about
the kill your father conundrum? And
yeah, there are no time travel paradoxes. If you just look at a book by Igor Novikov, who's a very respected, he was Soviet, now Russian physicist, explains all those things why they don't really happen. And then there have been a lot of detailed studies in Physical Review showing that under detailed models that all the paradoxes are basically avoided. And what happens is that even if you try to create a time travel paradox, either you're going to jump into a parallel universe or there'll be some kind of synchronicity, Jungian synchronicity effect, which will thwart your plan.
Now, this brings up so many questions. I mean, you think
there's no free will.
You think there are maybe an infinite number of parallel universes running at any given time?
Okay, now, this is not Jack Sarfatti talking, but this is really the physics community talking, like Stephen Hawking, Max Tegmark, all the big shots in physics. They go. Michio Kaku is very good on this. Michio Kaku, who is a professor of physics at City University in New York,
does a great show on KPFA.
Who does his show, and he's very good at explaining all this. His books are very good, and it's the mainstream view. Technically, it's called chaotic inflationary cosmology, but it's the mainstream view that our universe is only one universe in an infinity of parallel universes, all floating like bubbles in a champagne cocktail, right, in what's called extra-dimensional hyperspace. And so that is actually not so much my crazy theory. Right. It's everybody else's crazy theory. It's even crazier than my theory. I'm sort of conservative compared to that.
So you actually are more conservative than that? You think, well, there's a limited number of dimensions? Or,
yeah.
String theory says what? There's 28?
Right. Now, string theory. It shows, it's kind of like decadence in physics. What's happened is that a lot of the old, some of the old time physicists like Shelley Glashow and even Steven Weinberg, they think that all these developments in string theory are basically kind of pseudoscience. And like Brian Greene, who's making all those millions of dollars selling string theory, it's kind of a hype. It's sort of like a con game, cosmological con game. Who knows? I know Roger Penrose doesn't really like it either. If you look at Roger Penrose's book, The Road to Reality, you'll see some serious criticisms of string theory.
I know your friend Saul Paul Surratt got into it for a while.
Oh, no. So I think Saul Paul is into it because Saul Paul is really mathematician. The mathematics of it is beautiful.
Right.
But don't get me wrong. The string theory as conceptual art, you know, for a very smart guy like Saul Paul Surratt, he gets hypnotized by it because the math is so beautiful. But whether or not you really need it to describe all the interesting observational anomalies that are being described today, which actually explain how the extraterrestrials and their flying saucers get to us without, you know, even though it's millions and zillions of light years, you don't really need string theory, although that's not to say that string theory may not be important later on. But
let me interrupt you here. Yeah. Why do you think there are extraterrestrials, and how do they get to us?
Well, they get through metric engineering.
Through
wormholes, yeah. They get to us through wormholes, and they even either naturally occurring wormholes that have existed for a long time, so you could really use them for time travel back in time. See, in principle, if you have a wormhole, you cannot travel back in time to a time before the wormhole came into being.
I think you were probably the first person that I heard of that argued that extraterrestrials were time travelers rather than space travelers.
Yeah, that goes back actually at least to 1973. Saul Paul Surratt has a tape recording of a meeting I had with Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ and Brendan O'Regan, various people around Edgar Mitchell's Noetic Sciences group when they were testing Uri Geller and the other psychics, Ingo Swann. And, we were just discussing that as way back in 1973. In fact, Saul Paul even wrote an opera that was produced in Berkeley in 73-74 based on my theory of going backward in time.
That's a great time for it.
Yeah, right. So that's true what you said, yes.
What evidence would you say there is for the basic assertion extraterrestrials among us?
Now, we have to distinguish between folkloric anecdotal evidence that's not scientific and also real scientific evidence, okay? As to real scientific evidence, I don't really have any, but I can say that there are several mainstream physicists who are taking this idea quite seriously. And there is a book, Time Travel, I forget, is it by Gott, G-O-T-T, a physicist at Princeton, that discusses a similar idea, though his book was published only recently. I mean, you know, I was into this many years ago. So in terms of scientific empirical evidence, the only real evidence, I would say, are the UFO phenomena, some of the UFO phenomena. And then in terms of non-scientific, I want to be very clear, it's non-scientific, but anecdotal oral history, my own close encounter of the, third, fourth kind when I was a kid. And also Uri Geller's, who I've been seeing a lot of Uri lately in London. Geller had a parallel, very similar experience at around the same time I had mine.
Do describe that. A number of Jack Sarfati fans have, of course, heard this story.
Yeah, it's in the book.
Many others haven't, and it's a great, really interesting story.
And actually, Robert Anton Wilson talks about it in his Cosmic Trigger books and some of his Illuminatus trilogy, and also Jeffrey Mishlof talks about it in Roots of Consciousness, and it's definitely in my book, Destiny Matrix. And also it's on a video. It's on Thinking Aloud with Jeff Mishloff. One of the shows, Thinking Aloud, has the whole story. And basically what happened was when I was about 13 years old, I was alone in my apartment, telephone rings, and I pick up the telephone, and it's like a mechanical relays. This is like 1953. Mechanical relays clunking, and I hear like a cold metallic voice that sounds exactly like Stephen Hawking's artificial voice today, except this is back like 52. Is it how long ago? It's 52. My God, it's quite
1952.
A while ago.
I have it here 52, in my notes.
Right, yeah.
When
so
I
that's,
was born,
that's 50
actually.
Years ago. About, yeah, a little more than 50 years ago. So, any case, and it says, I hear it like the metallic voice is giving a sequence of integers of numbers, and then it sort of says, "Jack, is this Jack? We're looking for Jack." And I said, "Yes." And it says, "It's a conscious computer on board a spacecraft." And so, yeah, I was a kid. I was into science fiction, and at the time, I was reading about the ENIAC computer. I had a big switching circuits book from the Eastern Parkway Library, and I figured, oh, it's some of my friends, you know, kidding around. I'm a New York City street kid, you know, same neighborhood Woody Allen was growing up in, went to Midwood High School. And so right away, oh, yeah, sure. And then I realized, well, my friends, they're all kind of dumber than me, and I'd be the only one kind of diabolical enough to come up with this kind of crazy thing. So this was going through my mind. So then I sort of got scared. I was fascinated, but also scared. And they said that it said that they had identified me among, I think they said 400 other bright, receptive minds that they wanted to teach their technology to, their secret technologies to, and that if I agreed to do it, I had to make my own free choice. If I agreed to do it, I would begin to meet the others in 20 years, which would be like 1973, 1974. Right. And I remember thinking to myself, something scared the rest of the family. And I was thinking to myself, no, no. And then I felt like a chill go from the base of my back of my spine up to my neck, which later found out was like a Kundalini thing, so I'm a 13-year-old kid. And I heard myself say yes. And they said, then the voice says, good, well, we'll send a ship to go out to your fire escape, and we'll send a ship to pick you up within 10 minutes. So that when I realized it, go out to my fire escape, I knew whoever this was, they knew I had a fire escape.
Right.
And I was getting really scared. So I got really scared. I slammed down the phone. I ran downstairs, got a couple of my friends. It was, like, I think, a fairly nice summer night, and found two or three of my friends. And I went upstairs. I've been contacted by flying saucer. And we went upstairs. We waited. We looked out on the fire escape, and nothing ever happened.
Hmm.
Okay.
So what's your analysis of that?
Well, that's only the beginning of the story.
Oh, all right.
Because then 20 years go by, and I'm now a professor of physics with Fred Allen Wolf at San Diego State University, about the early 30s. And all kinds of, I got to make a long story short, but the details are all in the book, Destiny Matrix. And what happens is that suddenly a guy, an old friend of Fred Allen Wolf, and, you know, Fred Allen Wolf is the author now. He's in What the Bleep Do I Know.
Right.
He's kind of a superstar. I mean,
and he co-wrote
the book Space Time Beyond. We had adjoining offices at San Diego State. And at that time, he was like a 35-year-old associate professor, senior to me. I was a 28-year-old assistant professor, and it was sort of like Feynman and Gell-Mann, sort of, you know, joining offices, and we were all pretty crazy. And this was during the sexual revolution and all that stuff. So what happened? We both sort of divorced, or our wives divorced us at that time, and we were living together sort of like in under the yum-yum tree kind of situation at the edge of the campus, you know, like the odd couple kind of, you know, with all the student girls and stuff like that. I mean, we were parodied at the beginning of Ghostbusters.
Oh, so you're in Ghostbusters too?
Oh, yeah, because
is there any
because Aykroyd? This is all due to Esslinger.
Is there any mad scientist movie that?
We were the bait, because you got to remember we were at Esslin, and we were hanging out with Francis Ford Coppola and Spielberg, all these guys, you know. Right. And it's a whole other story, but the fact is, yes, that's true. And so what happened is that one of Fred's friends from high school, Bob Tobin from Chicago, shows up and starts telling us about Uri Geller.
Right.
Okay, which I mean, Fred and I were pretty straight. We had never even smoked a joint because Fred had a military Air Force contract. I was also working for the Navy. We're at San Diego, a Navy town. I had been a graduate student at La Jolla. I was married, and we, you know, Fred used to wear Bermuda shorts and had short hair, and he used to drive a blue, powder blue Aston.
Those are the freaks you got to watch out for.
Yeah, yeah. Austin Healey. Very straight. All right. Had three, four kids. He lived next door to Jonas Salk, who was, at that time was married to, you know, the ex-wife of
Francois
Picasso and all that. And we were, you know, I was working for Keith Bruckner. I mean, it was all very Project Jason. It was all very, very sort of defense industry oriented.
So what happened?
Bob Tobin shows up and starts talking about Uri Geller and this Israeli psychic, and he does weird things like bending metal. And he said he had a television contract and a book contract and needed Fred, and then so he met me to sort of be technical advisors for a television show about Uri Geller. Of course, we didn't know what was going on, really. So, you know, plus Bob said the magic word. He said he had a lot of money to do it.
That always works.
That always works, too. So we got and he was staying with us. So we're all staying with us. And at the time, I had this zany graduate student from a very wealthy family in Geneva. And he had a party. And I remember Fred, Bob, and me, and I think Jagdish, my Indian friend Jagdish, who's still around, and we went down to his house, and for the first time, he got a stone. We didn't even know what it was, but he brought out this big water bowl with hashish, and, you know, so we got really, for the first time, you know, naive, like virgins, you know.
Sure. That'll slow time down. That'll slow time down.
And so that had a big effect. I don't know what was it. Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's a cartoon characters come to life. Oh, okay. It's sort of Terrence McKenna type trips. So, So what happened was then suddenly Fred gets invited to Europe to a joint appointment at the University of Paris and one at the University of London through a friend of his. And at the same, within a few days, I get a phone call from Abdus Salam, he's the head of the theoretical physics at Imperial College of Science and Technology in London. It also runs what's called the International Center for Theoretical Physics in Trieste, Italy, which is also run by UNESCO and the International Atomic Energy Authority, and sort of where third world physicists and at that time it's Cold War still, you know, 70s, Soviet bloc physicists and Western physicists all kind of come together. It was a real kind of, and I was invited to that. See, all of a sudden. So all of a sudden, both Fred and I, we're sort of plucked out of San Diego State and we're on our way to Europe. And at the time, I had a girlfriend, and her mother lived in Carmel Valley. And just prior to me going over to Europe, I was in Carmel Valley, and I opened up the Sunday San Francisco Chronicle magazine. Mm-hmm. And there's a big spread, big article, lots of photographs about the experiments at Stanford Research Institute on Uri Geller by Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ and the astronaut Edgar Mitchell. And, of course, I mean, you got to understand that this is 20 years after the phone call.
Right.
Right? 20 years after the phone call. How would it be known that I would actually read the Sunday magazine to see this article?
When you started connecting to the psychic research.
Because Uri Geller had the
others.
Experience.
They said you'll begin to meet the others in 20 years. So he was like right on schedule. Although I wasn't thinking that at the time. I didn't make that connection. Yeah. That it's only in hindsight now.
All right.
So what happened was it's Sunday. I'm supposed to leave for London on Wednesday. And it's Sunday. Early Monday morning, I call up and Brendan O'Regan gets on the phone and give it to Brendan O'Regan and says, yes, Dr. Safadi, we were hoping you would call us. Would you please come up to Stanford Research Institute?
Oh, so that's pretty good. We were expecting you.
We were expecting you.
I'm afraid that we've actually run out of time for this show, but have no fear, folks out there listening and enjoying it. We're recording another half hour with Jack Sarfati, and we'll be bringing it to you in a few weeks. So, thank you, Jack, and thank you for sticking around.
This is like the old
more conversation.
Yeah, this is like the old serials, you know. Tune in next week.
Yeah.
Are you going to record it now while we
see
The Are You Serious Show is taking a week off to recalibrate our space-time dimensions. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the father of contemporary pirate radio, Stephen Dunifer. In the meantime, keep your browsers pointed to mondoglobo.net for all the latest shows from the Mondo Globo Network. This has been the Are You Serious Show. Don't be afraid of the dark.
Good evening. This is George W. Bush. I'd just like you to know that I appreciate the Mondo Globo Network at mondoglobo.net. I think it's good for America. Me and Dick, we sit down in our living rooms, and we like to listen to Mondo Globo, especially the Are You Serious show, Neophiles, and especially Pastor Jack. We don't exactly agree with his policies and procedures, but we think he's a good Christian, and that's good for America. George W. Bush thinks Mondo Globo Network is Hi, I'm George W. Bush. I think MondoGlobo.net is bitchin'. I think you should all listen to it. And besides, if you don't want to support terrorism, listen to MondoGlobo.net. Thank you, and God bless America.